Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm Giuseppe Porcaro.
I am Maria De Mergis.
I am Nicola Viegi.
And in this episode, we will look into low interest rates in Europe and the United States and how this common trend tells us two different stories across the Atlantic. Maria and Nicola have just written a paper on the topic, which is linked in our show notes, and you can read it on free access on the Bruegel website. And today, we will shed some light about what such trends matters and what kind of policy implications do they have. In both Europe and the United States, interest rates have been declining for more than 15 years, and for much of these periods, real interest rates have been negative. And you mentioned, Maria and Nicola, in your paper that the expectation is that real rates will be negative probably 30 years from now, a very long time ahead. Can you help us understand why, but especially why does it matter?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, thanks very much, Giuseppe. And I'm also delighted that Nicola has joined us today to discuss this paper. I just wanted to perhaps kick start the discussion by talking about the motivation. And actually, Giuseppe, it's exactly what you said. A couple of years ago, as we were writing the paper to when there was a change of guard at the European Central Bank, so a new president came in, we wrote a little memo at Bruegel in which we were trying to introduce the type of tasks that the new central bank governor will have. And in doing so, we looked at what markets thought about kind of the price of capital, the interest rate. When we first drew that graph, we realized that, as you said, Giuseppe, that the interest rates had been long for a long time, and the markets were expecting the interest rate to stay very low for a rather long time. Now, how far outside in the future? 30 years is a long time. Markets are not very informative that far down. But 10 years ahead, there is markets that tell us or give us information that is actually interesting. And you know, when you actually combine that with information about inflation, then we discover that the markets were telling us that, you know, interest rates, real interest rates, so the real price of capital is going to remain negative. And that kind of raised the kind of interesting questions. What does it mean for the price of something in real terms to be negative and actually expected to remain for such a long time is as though the real price of capital was becoming negative in equilibrium. You know, that kind of, as a macro modeler, that kind of threw us a little bit. And therefore, I teamed up with Nicola to try and sort of understand why and, you know, find out what we can do about it. And this is actually what the paper is about.
Nicola, do you want to...
Yeah, I think what is very interesting about this topic is that very soon we start to look about what are the fundamental dynamics that are driven this price. Therefore, a price is just an indicator of something underlying that. A price is, there is a demand, there is a supply. In this case, is a demand, a supply of saving, or the investment saving balance. But behind that, there is very much what is happening in the firm, what is happening in the economic structure, how this economy is changing so much that the price of capital become lower and lower and lower. And therefore, we ended up talking a lot about innovation, about the technology, about what has happened to markets, market concentration, competition, and innovation processes. Therefore, it's been a journey of thinking about what are the fundamental changes that these economies are experiencing and how we can get out of this situation. What are the levers that we can use to move in a situation in which, you know, investment is growing and therefore there is an increased demand of savings and therefore we get out of this sense of stagnation that this indication of low interest rate for long gives. And I think it's very instructive for us, and I hope it will be instructive, it will be interesting for the readers or for the listener to this discussion.
My question is, like, so you find that all in all that there is a reduction in the overall demand for capital, if I understand correctly?
It's actually both. But in the sense that at the beginning, when the literature started, very much we are economists, it's demand and supply, therefore what is increasing the supply of saving and what is the reducing the demand of saving or the investment. And therefore, the Summers' secular stagnation story was very much an issue of there is too much investment, there is not enough savings. And the story was, there is a saving glut in the emerging countries, or there is a saving glut because of the increasing inequalities, therefore the rich are saving too much, and there is too much macroeconomic risk, especially after the crisis, therefore a lot of precautionary saving, therefore this increase in saving that we experience, while at the same time there is a collapse of or a reduction in investment because of demographic characteristics. For if a continent like Europe become older, your horizon is smaller, therefore you will have lower level of investment. And there is a very big reduction in the relative price of capital goods. Therefore, the typical example, if before you had to connect people with the telephone, you had to put a lot of capital investment to do that. You had to put line on the ground. Or nowadays, the level of capital investment that you need to achieve the same level of production is much lower because of technology innovation. This one move more and more towards what is happening in the production process, why we don't need capital anymore, or why, because of the reduction of interest rate, we don't experience an increase in investment. If capital is so cheap, why we don't see an explosion in investment? Easy enough to talk about macroeconomic risk or to talk about demographic to explain these secular trends.
When you speak about the fact that there is some sort of less need for capital, less demand for capital, on the other hand, it seems to me that there is one element which maybe, Maria, you can explain a bit more in detail. In principle, the fact that there is such technological change shouldn't increase productivity rather than decrease. So to a certain extent, shouldn't this be reflected into an increase of demand overall, also for capital, if we look at the macro level, at the global level?
Perhaps I can offer an example in this respect. Yes, it is an observation, and this is actually part of the paradox here, that despite all this technological innovation that we hear and see about everywhere around us, actually we observe a reduction in productivity. And in fact, part of the literature, this vast literature has been written on this, in saying the interest rates are the result of this productivity coming down. And the question is, why is productivity coming down, right? Could it be a measurement, or is it really a reduction in productivity despite all this increase in innovation, right? Now, in trying to understand why the interest rate has come down, when you observe a price coming down, it's either the demand is coming down or there is a relatively excess in supply. And this is the part that Nicola is talking about the demand for capital, physical capital, has come down because we don't need it as much. What does that even mean? Well, think about Facebook. When Facebook was created, it had Harvard or Purdue. This was the population that was using Facebook. It expanded to MIT, then went to Stanford. With very little investment, it tripled, quadrupled, and then, of course, exponentially increased the reach of its population and, of course, the monetization of its product, right, through commercials. It was very easy for a digital company like Facebook, and that example can translate into other things as well, to multiply its turnover with actually very little investments in physical capital, maybe an extra computer, an extra server. Very quickly, they managed to do that. And this is a characteristic of the digitization of the economy. As we become more and more digital, in relative terms, compared to previous innovations in history, we need less physical capital. We need more what we call intangible capital. And therefore, the price of physical capital that we need to pay comes down. This is a very recent phenomenon, and it's actually part of the reason why the price of capital is coming down.
So basically, you are adding this layer to the other elements that you were mentioning before. Nicola, you mentioned aging, you mentioned also other factors. So it's not just technology alone that is providing the situation we are in.
Actually, what we start to look at, we look at the literature, is also what is the effect of this kind of technological innovation. Therefore, now essentially we are moving from physical capital to intangible capital, and we are moving towards a higher level of increasing, if you want, increasing return to scale. Therefore, there is a big gain in terms of rent of positional dominance. Therefore, it's not the technological innovation itself that produces this reduction in interest rate, but it's really one of the effects of this innovation is that it has affected market structure all over the world. Therefore, what we see is an entire sector in which there is more a winner-take-all environment, in which few firms, if you look at the most valuable firms in the history of the U.S. stock exchange, in the history of the world, actually, is either oil companies or these new technological companies. Therefore, these new technological companies are the most valuable companies in the history of the world. But in terms of actual investment, it cannot be compared to a Chrysler or a GM. Therefore, the dominant position and what we see is a reduction of the level of competition. And therefore, a reduction of the level of contestation of market that will generate the new wave of innovation.
Basically, if I understand correctly, you're saying that because we have these technological changes and there is this huge technological market, you have less investment in capital because those markets require less fixed investments or like fixed infrastructure. And this is the first point. And then the second point that you're saying is that there is almost, I wouldn't say a monopoly, but there are like few players on that field, which basically are eating all the sector. And that situation compelled to not having the kind of investments that you would like to see on that side.
Yes, because it's very difficult for others to enter in the market. But even in other, consider the sectors like transport like with Uber or hotel with Airbnb. Now, these are technologies that are disruptive of entire markets. That's okay. Technology is always disruptive, and that is how it should be. But technology, then, the first mover has got a position that can easily become a monopoly position, that you acquire so much power that you are able to control processes, you are able to build up barriers to entry, you are able to buy out new innovators. That is exactly what we see. Now, this innovation produces change, but if you don't allow innovation to continue, therefore, if you don't set the rules that allow others to contest the market, then what you will see is a reduction in productivity, is a reduction in innovation, and therefore a possibility of stagnation as a result, not of innovation itself, but how the innovation is governed in a global economy in which the economies of scale, the gain from dominance are enormous.
If I may add to that, actually, what is different in the digital era is that the digital innovation allows those who come in to develop very fast because of the need of less capital investments. And once you establish what they call the winner takes it all type of companies, it's very difficult to allow for anybody else to come in. So what you do as a company is you build up barriers and you prevent others from coming in. A fact that in a global economy and in a digital economy, was there are no borders in a digital economy, is exacerbated through scale. So, the dominant companies are not just domestic in one country. They actually, particularly when this country is the US because it's big, but also China now, I think we will see some of these. You actually find that these are sort of globally dominant. And therefore, it has repercussions beyond its current borders. And here, I think, is the point where perhaps we can start talking about the US versus Europe, because there's some interesting issues that arise out of this. What we described up to now is very much done in the context of the US. Is very much a US thing.
I would like to go more in-depth indeed between this US-EU story. I think that's very centerpiece of your paper, so I want to focus a little bit more on that aspect. But before finalizing this more general reflection, Nicola mentioned the oil companies, as a matter of fact. I don't know if you asked yourself this question, but before the oil crisis of 1973, also the oil market had main institutionalized players, the famous Seven Sisters, that were having the 85% of the world's petroleum reserves, controlling and distribution and so on, And then the oil crisis arrives, and then OPEC arrives, and the situation becomes a bit more complicated than that. But how much, I don't know if you ask yourself the thing, how much we are in the situation where these big digital companies might enjoy the same privileged position that those Seven Sisters were enjoying in the pre-1973 situation, And I wonder, within this frame, if at some point we're going to have a 1973 scenario within the digital world, you know, where things are going to be shaken up somehow.
You can even go back. I think you point something through, that this element of concentration and monopolization after a wave of technological innovation has always been part, if you want, of the development of capitalism. After all, the competition policies as an idea, the Sherman Act in the US was exactly to stop big corporations that monopolize. The Bell was the telephone, the communication monopolies that was, split up the Bell company or the oil companies in US. Therefore, there was a lot of an entire new economics was born out of having to limit the monopoly power of the first winners of the different wave of technological innovation. And we are a bit on that stage. There is a new technological innovation that obviously you cannot regulate before it happens because you don't know how it's going to evolve. Now you see how this is evolving and what are the limits of this evolution. In US, we see a reduction in competition that affects the world because, as Maria said, this is global market. And therefore, in US, you start to think about how to limit the power of this because also is a very strange power compared to, the oil companies because they or the Bell. Because here is a power that goes not only on the economic, but goes on the social element, affect the politics, affect so many aspects of our life in terms of we provide these companies with a lot of private data that is the new oil of this economy. And therefore, how we regulate the use of this data, how we internalize the negative externalities that the use of the data might have. And therefore, there is a lot of very interesting issue in terms of how we rethink competition policy in a world of this kind. And I think the European Union has done quite a lot of work and a lot of thinking in trying to be the regulator or somehow to regulate this. But you are absolutely right. It's not unlike other time. I think the only difference is the space of the digital economy. That is not only affect a lot of personal use of data that is quite in the social political element in a way that is much more direct and therefore can have a negative externality we have seen that could be quite dangerous.
I just wanted to add to this and actually reiterate what Nicola said about, every sort of innovation, wave of innovation, not just, the innovation from day to day. I'm talking about the disruptive innovations, those that really push us ahead, brings with it some sort of new sense of understanding economics. And I think this kind of innovation, the current disruptive innovation, is one of them. We're in the cusp of what I would like to think as new economics, but because there are interesting elements that are important that we don't understand, and regulation and the ability to monitor these guys requires that we understand the economics that are behind it. I'll give you two examples which I think are very important. The first one is, how do you establish monopoly power? In typical economics, monopoly power is about price. We are in a world where consumers don't pay a price for accessing the digital economy. In fact, what we pay is with data. We worry about our data, but price we don't pay. We are in a world where, if you like, the standard economic model is going to be what we call the multi-sided economic model, economies with multiple sides. And there, identifying monopoly power is going to be very difficult. We'll come back to this when we talk about the policy discussion at the end. So that's one. The second one is, Nicola talked about the new oil. I think data as the new oil is, of course, interesting. It's also a little bit misleading. I remind you that oil is a depleted resource. Data is not. And this is what I think is kind of the things that are kind of very different in the new world of this digital economy, because data is infinite. And, in economics, value comes from scarcity. And, how do we derive value out of an input? Because that's what data is. You monetize it, you use it, and you sell it. Out of an input that is infinite, right? How do we get value out of that? And this is the bit that, if you like, economics 101 will have to sort of reconsider
Now that's extremely interesting. And you point out a question that we could dedicate just a series of podcasts around that, about is data really an infinite resource? It's a finite resource. I mean, what exactly it means? I think that we are just at the beginning of trying to understand this new economy around data. So it's extremely, extremely important and fascinating. I think that now it's the moment to explain a little bit to our listeners, what are your findings? Because you explained already a certain geographical origin of at least one big element of this situation we are in, which is the United States and which is the digital market specifically. You analyze very attentively and very carefully, and I would say in a very innovative manner, exactly which are the which is the story around this in the United States, but also which are the consequences in Europe. What exactly did you find out?
The difference is the difference between first mover and second mover, or third mover in this case. Therefore, the issue for the US is very much an issue of competitive environment. Right? The growth of these firms reduce the level of competition. There is a lot of work of Philip Pond. There is a lot of work and increase also the macroeconomic risk of entering markets. Therefore, and this one affects both in terms of natural monopoly that a lot of these firms are, both in terms of regulation of intellectual property that in US has favored the accumulation of power by a few firms, because it's a regulation that is very restrictive. Also because these firms have ability now to influence the regulatory framework as well. Therefore, there is a lot of analysis of the worsening of the competitive environment in US and how this is a limit to the growth of US itself. For the Europe is a story instead of second mover. Therefore, now we are not entering in this market because, if you want, we are subjected to the monopoly power of these external companies. And the issue for a second mover is how you allow an internal generation of new innovation. And because you want to contest these markets you want to contest the market, therefore the issue is how you do it. One way is the Chinese way. There is all, if you want, is the Bismarck way in terms of building up a protection by the state, a protection to build up internal champions, big champions, and after make them compete in the world. That is one way. But it's a way that, it's not the European way. It's a way also that imagine a world that actually breaks up, in which everybody, I would like the sort of the relation between Bismarck and the first mover at the time was UK. Therefore, you had to imagine the Europe, the position in Europe, thinking about how you use the regulatory power of Europe and its internal ability to enter a contest this market. And therefore, we look at a bit what are the conditions that stop Europe being a protagonist in this new innovation world.
Yeah, if I may add to, because there's bits to the puzzle that are kind of interesting to explore, and this is very much the way that we approach the issue. So it is, let's say, concentration power is an external phenomenon to the EU. It comes to the EU through the digitalization and globalization process. Actually, so much so that if you look internally only, there isn't really an issue of market concentration. In fact, if anything, there is now evidence that is coming up, which is telling us that actually market concentration is a good thing. To the extent that it has increased in Europe, is a good thing, because it's simply telling us that it is the most efficient firms that survive. You see, if it becomes too much, then it's a bad thing. But if it's manageable, it's telling us that actually it's a good thing. And this is where the preliminary evidence is telling us what is going on in Europe. However, the external side coming into Europe through the digital and global markets has also an effect on the ability of European firms to break in. That's the first piece of evidence that we find. The second one is we look a little bit more carefully at who buys new firms. Because Europeans are actually good for startups. We have skills, we have education. And, not unlike the US, European firms start up based on their own savings. We see the same thing in the US, and we see it also in Europe when, you know, young guys and the garage of their parents, they start a new firm. They're based on primarily on their own savings and family and friends' savings. And that's not so different from the US. However, what happens after that, the famous scale up, that doesn't happen in Europe. It's very difficult. And this is the bit where I think we need to sit back and understand why it doesn't happen and what it means for the macro environment, including interest rates. So we looked at what happens to young firms in Europe, young firms meaning firms that have existed for 10 years, and who buys them up, who scales them up. And we discovered that certainly in sectors like technology and financial, it is Americans who are really buying up firms much more than others. So there is many more American firms created. Many more American firms are being bought by Americans, but also the Americans are buying the European firms in disproportions, right? Europeans buy European firms as well. But this is kind of a tendency that those guys that are very big can actually buy over European firms and scale them up. Now, this is, of course, a good story. I mean, you know, if you're a startup in the EU, who cares who buys you? Does it really matter? Well, there is a side effect, which I think is not good for innovation. The types of things that Nicola was talking about is that, of course, there's competition that comes in any market. Young startup firms that come in compete with each other, and that's very good for innovation. 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 firms. However, when the first one, the best one, is being bought up, it completely kills the rest of the market. You see? So there isn't conditions that are going to allow the second, the third, the fourth, and the fifth firm to exist, and therefore create a dynamic environment and a big market. This is it's called the theory of harm, and it's actually an interesting thing to see. And the question is, why? Why are European firms not scaling up by themselves? Why don't they stay in Europe, and what can we do about it?
And that's exactly a policy challenge that is over there. And one of the policy challenges that you also focus on in your analysis in your papers, you spend some time to trying to find out what kind of reflections there are in the policy responses to this. And this completely different scenario, I suppose that the responses and also the aim of the policy making is completely different in the United States from what it is in Europe. Right?
Certainly, you know, if the problem is concentration of power and that's the distortion, this is something that we need to fix. And, you know, the European Commission came out as a champion in regulation, came out just before Christmas with 2 initiatives on exactly this, in which they say, listen, if you're big, we're going to monitor you, you know, big in ways that are identifiable. It doesn't say we're going to penalize you, but it says we're going to monitor and just see how you operate because, you know, we feel that you're distorting the markets. That's the idea behind all of this. That's one thing. And of course, it captures all firms. It doesn't capture only firms that are operating in Europe, of course, but it captures also their operations in the rest of the world. I mean, if you're a big firm, you're a big firm everywhere, right? So that's an issue. It's called the extraterritorial element of it, is that, you know, we will be regulated. We'll be looking at your operations globally because this is a global market. That's one thing. I personally, and here I think, you know, I don't know what you think, Nicola, but I mean, you know, similar initiatives need to follow in the US if we're really going to sort of manage this concentration of power. And if you don't, can Europe really regulate global markets? I think that's probably something that we need to think about. That's one thing. In Europe, it's not really the concentration of power. Okay, the DSA, the DMF, and the European Commission will do that. In Europe, it's really, why is it that all these young talented firms don't scale up? And that's I think, the problem we need to tackle on. And, you know, there that brings us back to, you know, how do we create risky capital in Europe? The risky capital is the capital that is going to go to these young firms and is going to allow them to develop markets. That, of course, relates directly to the capital markets union agenda, for which we have not seen much progress, which is really something that I very much regret, given how important it is. Not only that, but remember the importance of intangible capital. Intangible capital in this process is not easy to collateralize. And in Europe, we rely on a growth model that finances growth through collateral. So effectively telling us that this bank finance system of Europe is not very well prepared for the digital world where, you know, most of the capital needed is risky capital because it cannot be collateralized. If you're a young digital firm, you don't have much collateral, 5 computers and 3 people, that's it. It's difficult to scale up without the collateral. So I think those are my first thoughts on the policy side.
Coming back to the interest rate story. So the fact that we have lower interest rates, I mean, what is the impact, especially on the last thing that Maria has been mentioning, the fact that especially for the situation of young startup in Europe, how this affects them directly?
I think you have to think about the interest rate as an indicator of the lack of dynamism. Therefore, that is more a symptom of these structural weaknesses behind. The issue is that the firm, small innovative firms, is not able to access capital, doesn't matter what the interest rate is. Because if I have to access capital through the banking system, either I have something to collateralize that often will be your house or your own saving, therefore increasing the risk of that entrepreneurship, or otherwise I'm not able to access capital to scale up. Therefore, the interest rate is so low, the interest rate is negative, means that even with negative interest rate, I'm not able to access capital. There is not enough demand of capital given what the structure of the economy is. Therefore, is in some senses, the reform of the capital market and together a sort of a more general reform that favor young people, favor innovative firms, favor flexibility in labor contracts in way. Therefore, you need to have a whole system that is really promoting the innovation and the new generation economy. And one important part of the system is the finance. Without a system that is able to share the risk with the entrepreneur, if there is no risk sharing, and therefore, and also a different attitude towards potential failure. And therefore, it's about also bankruptcy law and how the finance share the risk with the entrepreneur that will generate enough demand of new capital and also enough supply of new capital for moving away from the stagnation. When we grow and when we have innovation, then the natural rate will grow because the return on capital will increase.
To a certain extent, and I look at Maria, but also we are coming towards the end of this episode, but what you said again, Nicola, resonates to me with something that both of you already have been writing about, which is the condition of uncertainty that we are in, because to a certain extent, you say basically the capital is so cheap in the market and so on. It's somehow not a result of the fact that there is a lot of capital available for new initiatives, for risk sharing, but it's actually because there is a risk adverse attitude around, which is very much similar to the point that you make in the other paper, which, by the way, we will also link in the show notes about uncertainty and how uncertainty, you know, has consequences. Would you agree with me, Maria?
The issue of uncertainty, as you know, is very close to my heart. And I think it's a very important part of what we call risk, right? And, you know, part of dealing with uncertainty is this risk sharing. And risk sharing in Europe means one thing, but here in the context of this paper is about risk of investments, risk of growth, risk of innovation. Every process has got risks. If we can find better ways of sharing risks, then you advance on the risk taking and therefore you achieve more results. I give you one number that we also quote in the paper, which I think is very telling in terms of culture. And that's actually because a lot of it boils down to culture and attitude to culture. The risky investments, the venture capital that is actually risky capital, is the type of capital that picks winners. They wait for firms and they evaluate and then they invest in them. And they're quite risky. They take big risks when they invest. The extent of venture capital in the US is tenfold that of the best performer in the EU, right? I mean, and that includes the UK. The UK, when it comes to capital markets, is somewhere between the US and the EU. But when it comes to venture capital, because I'm talking about that risky element of investments, the US tenfold. You know, this is an attitude issue. It's how do you approach risky investments? How do you approach riskiness? What is your attitude to failure? You know, and therefore insolvency laws matter in this respect. So I think that's an important thing. And the other reflection of this, and we do talk about this, we attempt to find out measurements of risk. We really do find that European markets are a lot more risky than American ones, than US ones. And therefore, you know, the markets are kind of, you know, they require a bigger risk premium to invest in Europe than they do to invest in the US. These are things that can be facilitated by structural reforms. So how do we, change the culture of investment, make supply of capital available, in particularly in the knowledge economy that cannot be collateralized? So I think, uncertainty is a very big component of this. And managing uncertainty requires robust strategies, so diversify, do many things. One of them is don't rely just on one financing model, which is the bank financing model. Look at other means of finance that can diversify risk.
Absolutely. Nicola, would you like to have some final remarks before we close to this episode?
My final remark is this. I think it's critical for Europe to think in terms of structural reform in this way. The structural reform that Europe needs is to start to think to the future, to really think about what are the challenges of the future. And if Europe is not able to be in this game of innovation and digital innovation, Europe will become the tourist spot of the world, but will not contribute to setting the rules of the world, setting the principle, setting the economy of the world. Therefore, it's critical when we think about structural reform, not only think in terms in a passive way, which I think in terms of the past, is that this structural reform, when we think about the reform, for example, the financial sector, we have to think about not only in terms of financial stability, but in terms of what is the role the finance need to have in the next wave of growth and innovation of the economy. When we think about the reform of the labor market, the reform of the welfare state, is all about how do we reform the institution so that we accelerate the entrance of new generation in the production of knowledge and the production of innovation and new product and new processes. Therefore, it's become a much better, a much more positive way of thinking about the kind of reform that Europe needs. Because if you think about, building a stronger, but also a more dynamic and more proactive protagonist in the world. Therefore, that's what this one is a beginning of a discussion about, this kind of structural reform for Europe.
Maria, your last remarks.
Yeah, it's difficult to top this up, actually, after this comment. I mean, I couldn't agree more with this. And I think that was very much the result of kind of this journey of understanding the literature. I just wanted to loop back in the paper, because the paper is what I would call a sort of a plain vanilla macro paper, where we're looking at interest rates are coming down while they're coming down, right? And, macro papers will stop at the point we say, it is really the real equilibrium interest rates coming down, policy can't do very much about this. And it is true. Policy can't do very much about macro policy in any case. Monetary policy, what can monetary policy do? The interest rate will have to be close to the equilibrium rate. If the equilibrium coming down, then the nominal interest rate will have to come down. But it's also telling us something about fiscal policy. I mean, how can you generate demand in the context of an environment that, as we described, is actually stagnant simply because there are other forces there. So I think the one thing that I at least took from this paper is that if you want to answer that question, stop thinking macro and think micro. And, macro being a division of terms, think structural reforms, think about what does it mean about innovation, which is the thing that Nicola very well explained in his last comment. So, a macro paper that requires non-macro answers is, I think, a crucial element comes out of this paper.
And on this, even if we could go on for a little more, and not only a little, this is just an euphemism, of course, because we could stay for a marathon of this episode for discussing this and going even more deep into this. But we are going to come back to those issues in our conversations. I would like to thank Maria and I would like to thank Nicola. Thanks so much.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Giuseppe.
And I would like to thank all the listeners for joining in to The Sound of Economics. And I would like to remind everyone that you will find the link in the show notes for the paper written by Maria Nicola, which we mentioned several times in this episode. And as usual, you can read the full library of the open access analysis and studies by our scholars on our website, www.bruegel.org. Until next time, bye-bye.